I have another suggestion. We should talk about topicalamy. You know what topicalamy is? You know what buttonicalamy is? Topicalamy is a term used chiefly by Fred Freeman and his immediate circle for a certain mode of thinking. It's made of the Greek topos, T-O-P-O-S, which means place, and economy, which means good household management. Topicalamy, topos economy, shortened to topicalamy. What it means is local intelligences can best solve local problems. Now today we have a double situation. Local economists know about local problems. Whitehall and Parliament may not. There are departments of the government that know nothing whatever about what's going on in higher council. I don't know what's going on in higher council. But somewhere in that place there will be people who live there and know whether or not the drains are blocked and whether something can be done about it. So the concept of topicalamy means local intelligences supplied with the appropriate information are better equipped to solve local problems than a central intelligence in the metropolis far away. Now we're going to see how this applies to the human being as well as to the nation. It need not be merely a political concept. Topicalamy could refer to the nation with its subdivisions and each town with its own council solving a local problem. Today we have computers. You can telephone head office in London or even around the world and get essential statistical information. And that's very useful to have a big central clearing office for information. But when we come to the local intelligence and the localized problem, that information from central office may have an application, but the application cannot be made except by people actually in that small situation. And we're going to use an illustration. The concept, the microcosm, that means little universe, man, and the macrocosm, big universe, are really in correspondence. There's nothing inside man, chemically, electronically, or in any way, that cannot be found outside man. So if we then consider the economy of a man's organism, we can see that topicalamy actually operates inside the individual man. I put to you a question. Who knows most about the function of kidneys? The kidneys or your left ear? You think the kidneys, probably. Well, the spleen knows about spleen work, and the liver knows about liver work. Even maybe about liverwurst. Essentially, that every organ in your body has been evolved over millions of years for a specific job. And it's done that job for so long, it is automatic. And providing it is not interfered with, it will do a very good job. Now in the brain we have the equivalent of a central computer. And all the information of all our experiences and those of all the people we know are stored up there. And the organs can send a message to central and say, how are you doing up there? Why this tension down here? Please remove it. If the central office up here with its total information behaves intelligently, it will feed back to the organ the appropriate energy that it needs. Let's think about this very carefully because it's very important. There is a will in your right side that is not identical with the left side. Just like your brain is parted in the middle, and part of it, the right side, is freer than the left. And your speech center, verbalization, rationalization, is a left side function, and your volitional creative side is a right side function. Your right side brain knows what it is going to do, Your left side brain knows nothing whatever about your deep intent of will. You know, Jesus said on one occasion, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. That means if you have an intention to do something, create something, a situation or a thing, that intention is in the will, and you keep it in the will, and you do not verbalize it, you won't get a reaction from the left side against it. But if you have a deep plan in the will, non-verbalized, and you can be very sure what it is, and you verbalize the intention, the left side brain immediately reacts by calculating the results of this act that you contemplate, and it may become very afraid of consequences. You know that if you may see somebody talking to you, maybe they're talking something you don't agree with at all, and you can feel a definite intention which you do not voice, this fellow needs a thump on the nose, really, and you might feel your punch muscles tensing and feel your inhibiting power holding those muscles in. While you're so feeling, you're not saying, I'll punch him on the nose. Certainly not audibly, because if you do, he'll dodge. But your own brain is saying, if I lash out now and miss, he might hit me. So your left side brain will rationalize all the defenses of an act which would, if allowed free expression, probably be violent. So let's think about a little circle, for man the microcosm, and a big circle for the whole universe. And they're in exact correspondence. And that being so, individual human beings are really local intelligences of the big human being called humanity at large. The Kabbalistic expression for that human being at large is Adam Kadmon, man in the box of the universe. The Adam, the universal man, is really a very big man, and he embraces total humanity. And we as individuals are little cells. Now inside the body we have a man in the head, a counter, and we have limbs and organs and cells, tissues and so on inside, and there is communication going on between the large man, the whole being, and the little cells. If you get a pin and stick it in you, the cell complains, sends a message to head office, you stuck a pin in me, don't do it again, otherwise I will dodge. And if you doubt this, all you have to do is get a match, strike it, hold it in your right hand, then hold the burning match under your left hand. You will find a tendency for the left hand to move away. Even if you tell it not to, in your my hand, you will stay here to demonstrate the point, and you will not tremble, and you will not suffer anything at all that can't be cured in a few weeks. I'm going to demonstrate that I am the Lord in this land of this body. And when you say that, you will find, nevertheless, the cells will cringe and they will tend to creep away. And this is because every single cell in the body, with the nucleus, has a resident intelligence, and it knows what it wants to do. The cells of each part of the body have evolved over millions of years. They've got their own solution to their own problem. They don't want unintelligent interference from a central intellective that has no sensitivity. You know, your brain is remarkably strange, that large tracts of the brain do not transmit pain. You couldn't afford it. So you can actually put probes in various parts of the brain, there will be no pain. But the corresponding part of the brain, the body cell, if you put a probe in that, it will feel pain. Now this part of the brain that's anesthetic has no regard for feeling sensitivity in its own cells. So athletes can push themselves beyond the limit, they can strain and stress, they can have pains during practices, and they can make their cells obey those pains. And the cells will do their best either to adjust to the demand made upon them, or they will pack in and the person will have a sudden something or another and sit down because it's been overworked. Remember that the rule for in the little circle is the same as the rule for in the big circle. And if we follow this to its logical conclusion and remember that our ancestry as human beings, our ancestry has a single root stock. In the book of Genesis, that's called Adam. And that root stock says, a man-woman, Ad-Ham, Ad means man and Ham means woman. A man-woman, a hermaphroditic type, existed long ago in which sexual differentiation, as we now know it, had not yet occurred. There was a perfect balance between feeling and intellection, between internal contemplation and external action. And then something happened to disturb this balance, and that something resulted in the marked differentiation of sexes to the point where there's hardly any mutual understanding between man and woman today. Now this basic primary egg, I'll draw you an ancient primary egg. I hope it doesn't look too bad. You know what an ancient primary egg looks like? Well, I won't bother you with the details. It looks like that. Now, we have a concept called topographical psychology. That means the psychology of place. And we can adapt this and use this in company with our topicality. If, I'll draw you another one here, like this, I'll draw it incomplete. If a stimulus like this comes, and the stimulus is pleasant, this protoplasm will flow towards the stimulus like that. And you all know what shape that is, don't you? That's an egg on its way to evolving into a womb. If the stimulus is pleasant, it flows towards it. When we look at an amoeba, which is a simple protoplasmic unitary mass, and we drop near it a little particle of food, the protoplasm of which it is made, which is nearly all water with a few mineral salts in it, flows towards the stimulus. And this is a kind of advent. This is a kind of moving. The stimulus is like a messiah. It's a savior of what? Well, if you didn't have any stimuli at all, nothing would happen. You'd be spherical, utterly undisturbed, and void of experience. So the same thing that we say here represents this primordial life possibility also represents O, zero, nothing at all. It represents no life, no experience. And if we give it a stimulus, then it will respond to the stimulus like an amoeba does in the water. Now, as when we put a pleasure stimulus, it moves towards it. So, if we put a horrible, jagged stimulus representing pain, it will actually withdraw like that. A painful stimulus is simply an excessive energy input. And if it's excessive, it means it will destroy, it will break down the protoplasm chemistry, and the being will be injured and will, if persisted in, disintegrate, which we call death. So we have two kinds of responses, a movement toward and a movement away. I'm going to turn this into a religious diagram. I'm going to draw upside down a Greek omega like this. That's an omega. Normally you'd write it like that. And I'm going to write alpha, also upside down, and that goes like that. Which you would write like that. Now that is a glyph. Now I already made a smear there. Did you notice that in time, I've got some ink on my hand now, we tend to become spotty. time and matter are the situations, the occasions of sin. And sin means private response. Susan Ann got that ink from there, and while it was still wet, I wiped some of my sleeves like this. I would get told off by Zero. She would say, "You spoiled your coat. You have sinned against the coat manufacturer." And this would be perfectly true, you see. I was a bit sly then in Camming, because I noticed it was dry before I did it. This is called raising Cain, becoming conscious of consequences. Now, if we say this letter A, entering into this omega represents the relation between the recipient, that's like a bowl, isn't it? That's like a nice ceramic bowl made by somebody with a kiln has made it. And that bowl is empty, waiting to be used. It is just like that primary egg. And if it isn't used, it is useless. It wants to be used in the way for which it was designed. This is why ladies, if they will pardon me giving away their game, often say to their husbands, "I want to be used, not abused." Find out the proper uses of a thing and then use it in all its happiness. Now this A represents absolute spirit. I'll do it the right way up now. The right way up this way. Represents a vulture. That's an archaic hieroglyph for a vulture. Vulture means vultura, the will to law. Now vultures don't eat you until you're dead. They look around and they see you struggling in the desert. They're full of kindness. They say, "You're not dead yet. Do not descend." But when you finally fall down and you don't move, they come up. And they don't eat immediately. They watch. Is there a flicker of an eyelid? Is there any sign of awareness there? But if there is, out of respect for life, I shall not eat it. But if it is really dead, I'll have a go. If I can get in it quicker than my companions, my fellow vultures. Now, in all religious scriptures, in all major religions, the meaning of the scripture is not the historical incident there represented. If you say, "Once upon a time, long ago, in ancient Iran, there was a prophet named Zarathustra, and he lived in such a town, and he was born on the 25th of December, which was his birthday," it is not referring to the historical event. It is referring to a spiritual principle of development. So in this case, this vulture mentioned is not referring to the bird in the sky, but the principle embodied in the bird that has respect for life and therefore only eats the dead. Now supposing we find in the Bible a statement, there are the quick and the dead. And we find that quick doesn't mean fellows that dart about in the traffic in their cars or on foot or on bicycles weaving in and out. That is not the quick. The quick are those quick on the uptake. Those that seize immediately and apprehend the truth that's hardly hinted at. But they're so quick of perception they can see the significance of a gesture, of a frown, of a little sneer. Anything, and they see that little gesture and they detect a movement of the will of that being. And they're able to deal with it because they have seen the movement of the will even before, generally, the person that's about to do it has become aware that he's going to do it. So they are the quick. Now the dead are those people who have such a routine thought process, a routine emotive response, routine physical behavior, so routine that you can predict it quite easily by a few observations, and you say that person has a tremendous habit, totally unconscious, and they will do so and so, end so and so in a few moments, and I can go up and offer him a chocolate eclair, if you like, and he will eat it. And he had a habit of those kind of things. And it could have a little bum in it, but he will eat it first and find that out later. They are the dead who are suffering from inertia at any level, physically, emotionally, mentationally, conceptually, not volitionally, because volition is initiative. You can't have an inertia of initiative. Initiative is always free and immediate in a now, here, instant. Now in this case, we said, religions are not talking about historical facts, although they use historical facts. There was a fellow called Pilate. There was a fellow called Herod. There was a fellow called Darius. And there was Akhenaten. All kinds of fellows who existed historically. But in the great religious scriptures, these persons are mentioned not because they were historical beings, but because they represented a type of possible response. So in this case, the vultures represent those fellows who are smart enough to be able to detect when a person has so much inertia that if you bite them, they won't wake up. They are dead. They call, in the Bible, dead in their sins, where sin means a private purpose. A private purpose makes you unconscious of things other than the realization of that purpose. So imagine inside you, you have tendencies to inertia, that means to repeat attitudes, physical, emotional, etc. You repeat these attitudes, and in so doing become predictable. Now a vulture type of person watches you, and he can see whether you are looking or not, whether you are alert, or whether you've fallen asleep to the situation. Like you might find somebody with a bag of sweets, and somebody with a very sharp eye sees there are three left and there are four people there. And he's seen this before the others have. So he sort of absent-mindedly takes one out and puts it on. Then he says, I'm terribly sorry, I have one. Well, three people left and only two sweeties there. I'm terribly sorry. Would you like to have this? Well, it's a bit sticky now. Perhaps not. You put it back in. Now that kind of mentality is a vulture. It's referred to as a vulture. The great religious scriptures, they say a vulture. They mean not the bird in the sky. They mean a very smart fellow that knows when you're asleep and won't eat you until you are. Now think what kind of peculiar thinking this is. It's called the mystic, the fourth level interpretation of holy scriptures. Remember, your bottom level is a material fact. Like once upon a time there was a second temple of Solomon, built of stones. There was. The second meaning is, it's allegorical. Solomon is really a peaceful ruler, and he makes the temple. It is the second temple, because the first temple was in the idea, in the mind. And the physical temple, actually built by the workers under the direction of the architect, that physical one is the second temple. The first temple is in the eidetic structures in the mind. Now the third level, called the homiletic level, is when you say to people, it'd be a jolly good idea for you to build a temple to the Lord. Do not think that I'm in the concrete business, but I will supply it to reduced rate, making allowances for VAT and inflation. But by next year it's doubled in price. Now, homiletics says, let's get together. Let's unify our powers and build this temple. I will supply the concrete, my brother-in-law will supply the wood, my second cousin will provide the Irish labour, and we'll build the temple, and it will be a marvellous tribute to the Lord. Many buildings have come out like that. I'm sure that when the Lord looks at the design of them, he's a little worried about the present state of evolution. Now we do have buildings that are put up, not only in Spanish holiday homes, they're up 6 months and they fall down. Something has gone wrong with the concrete mix or with the drawing board. When we contemplate in this manner, the homiletic it means to encourage somebody to do something for a purpose, but that is not the real meaning. The fourth meaning is that that temple is the human being himself in a state of perfect design with an intelligent architect named Logos, cosmic reason, and the whole building has been done by workers who love working, namely the energies in your own body. So imagine the fourth level of interpretation, the mystic level, the hermeneutic level proper. At that level, every statement made in a major religious parable, although it may use historical facts that have occurred or might have occurred, it does not refer to those external historical facts, but to the inner process of building the human being. The human being himself, perfectly balanced, perfectly harmonized, divinized, he is Solomon. He is the man of peace. He is the king, the Melech, who through perfect self-balance has built of himself with his own will, his own understanding, his own organism into a temple of peace. And therefore when Jesus said to them, if you destroy this temple, I will raise it, he was referring, and it says so in the passage there, not to that external temple, but to the temple of his body. Now, we are all temples of the living God. Now, the living God is infinite, sentient, intelligent power. That is the living God. We, and all intelligent beings, wherever they are cells inside that universal body of that God. Now, to become aware of that intelligent source, and to discuss internally, locally, what does my hand wish to do? What does my foot wish to do? What does my knee do? My bladder, my heart, my brain, and so on. To discuss internally in a power element of spirit inside the individual is to become acquainted with the process whereby, carried to its ultimate conclusion, it results in what is called the solarization or solidification or divinization of the human being. That is to say that the moment you become thoroughly aware of what you are, a little universe, identical with the big universe except smaller, with all corresponding parts and elements, forces, functions, capacities, all inside us, as we become aware of this fact, and we make ourselves act upon it, we then come into the state of self-creativity. We do not then respond like the unfortunates we do before in this manner. We don't retire from the pain, and we don't rush forward to the pleasure. When we rush forward to the pleasure, that could be bait. When we retire from the pain, that could be a method of putting us off finding a real value. So therefore, there is a process. It's the same in every religion, as far apart as Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Every religion says exactly the same thing in slightly different terminology. What it is saying is this: if you don't get dead, you cannot relive. Now we have inside ourselves reactivity, moving towards pleasure and away from pain. Now, the balanced original being is a pure sphere of possibilities. Now this is not a figure of speech, it's an actuality of cosmic energy. We have today, technologically, the means whereby we can actually measure biomagnetic forces in the body. and we can measure them outside the body. They extend. We have a biofield, and we have instruments now so sensitive we can actually get a reading from our body without touching the skin. We are a field, and that means a zone of influence, a field of bio that is living magnetic force. And that force, considered as encapsulated like that, is called soul. I'll write soul in there. I'll put a V on there, which is a U, to represent the developmental possibilities. William Blake reverses this and calls it loss. Soul means solo, it means one on its own. And it moves towards two opposite concepts, towards L and S. Here, in the middle, there is your whole potential. Here is the symbol, which is a V, which is a Latin U. And that is the potential of your whole potential. And you can move towards L or S. These are both possibilities within the soul. L means linkage. It means ligature. It means relationship. And S means separativity and sin. You have a potential of relating to other people, and we have a potential of refusing relation. If we relate, we're an L being, and if we don't, we're an S being. That S is originally a drawing of a serpent, and the L is a lamed, which is a goad and a link. Now, imagine this whole being here represents our own individuated being. Fundamentally, before the encapsulation, it is infinite spirit, that is intelligently diffused power. But when it wraps itself up and becomes a sphere of being, it receives a new name, soul, by simply wrapping itself up. Soul is spirit encapsulated. Spirit is the originating intelligent power which by self-encapsulation becomes soul. So you do not have a soul, you are a soul. To think about losing your soul and you still being there is an error of thought. You are a soul, that is to say, an encapsulated intelligent sphere of biomagnetic power. Magnetic because you can attract or repel with one pole or the other your date, your destiny, your fate, that which is given to you. The data of your life comes to you because you are magnetic. And you know, some people attract trouble and some people attract no trouble. Some people attract success. Now, the which way the thing jumps depends on the inner state of the being. We'll show what happens to the being. Here is the same being again. That's a being encapsulated. That being we have represented there, void. Nothing in it yet. But the word void is V-O-I-D. It means potential form. Potential form is the meaning of void. There could be form, but supposing we put no form in it and it refers to its own content, what does it find? It finds a blank mind. Now supposing we say, well, let's have a form in it instead, and then we have something to think about internally. So I'll put a form. The least we can have is a dot. Now I've got a dot in the middle, and that dot brings into being more than the dot, because now where there was void there is a dot, and there is a periphery, there are forces centripetal moving that way and forces centrifugal moving that way, and there is a rotation resulting from these double forces, and there's a periphery and a center and an in between. So by simply introducing one single dot, That's the smallest letter in the alphabet, the dot on the I, which is a yot in Greek and a yud in the Hebrew, the littlest letter. We immediately produce a highly complex relational situation. So that even with one form, the least, namely a dot, we become aware of the possibility of individuation. Now, individuality, which everybody prizes, means nothing but form. And the least form is a dot, a spot, a compaction of power. That compaction creates center. A centralized being is magnetic, in a way that a diffused being is not. So centralization, that is the focus of consciousness within oneself, to create a permanent center of reference, is just a synonym for success in anything you may undertake to do. Now, some people have said, well, if you've stolen that concept, I'm going to have another one. So one man says, well, here's my cell, and I will have a triangle in it. And I should think about that. You think about your dot, your centripetal, your centrifugal, your rotatory force, the relation between your periphery and your center, and the space between, which is free power. I will think about a triangle. And when we put a triangle inside the circle, we have said, let us think about triangles, three points of view. And one of the points of view, we'll say, is idea, and one is will, and one is act. Now, a person that does that says, I, with my will, publish an idea or form of action. And I'm never going to act without a form of the act, powered by my will. Now, you can see here, there's a difference of characteristics of those two beings. They have different references inside what previously was a void spherical being called a soul. Well, another fellow says, well, you've done it that way. I'm going to do it this way. I'll have a triangle, and I will have another triangle, and I'll have a dot. Now, these are what we call original totems of original peoples that became nations. That one, you see, will, idea, act. This one says, I'm going to think that the triangle with the apex up shall represent fire, and the one with the apex down shall represent water. And by fire, I mean energy, the initiative, the pushing of events. And by water, I mean plasticity, receptivity, relative passivity. So my center of individual reference there, I am I, like a Rastafari might say, I and I. I and I in the center there have a periphery here, but I have the concept in my mind that energy is initiative and passive feeling is inertia. I'm just being in my passive feeling, but with my energy I'm initiating changes. So if I meet somebody and I have this concept in my mind, I can say this other person may or may not know it, but I know it. He's got energy and he's got substance represented by water. He's got passivity, receptivity, and he can be stimulated. We can put the fire under the water and boil it and make tea. At which point another fellow says, that's a good idea. I'm going to have this, like that. I'm going to have a tea. Now that's a combination of the Jewish, Christian, Hindu symbol of salvation. We have the idea of centrality, we have the idea of the periphery, we have the idea of fire, energy, water, plastic substance, and we have the idea of the cross, fixation. Now you can see we're enriching the content by adding ideas, and we're recording the ideas with geometrical structures. Every time we do this, we enrich our mind and our emotions and our volitional possibilities, we enrich our capacity for life's response. If we thoroughly absorb these in meditation, we'll be a lot cleverer than we were when we had nothing in the mind. Now, it's possible to go on. If we went to a certain Irish Masonic lodge, they would say, well, this is the way we do it. We'll have it that way. And if you take the two triangles there and let one start at the dexter side, one at the sinister, and he said, that one represents the woman and that the man, and they're in mutual penetration, and there's a diamond in the middle. And that diamond, in Buddhism, is called the diamond body. Diamond means through the world. It means if you have that idea in your mind, wherever you go, you're penetrating people's minds, their emotional fields, their being, with your being, and they are penetrating you. And if you become conscious of that fact, you say, we're in a reciprocal relationship. Like William Blake said once in an argument with an angel. And the angel said to Blake, you have deceived me. You impose on me. And Blake said, we impose on each other. Every time you speak, every time you gesture, you have given a stimulus to the other person. And the reaction of that person to your stimulus is a stimulus to you. Now, if you know this fact and you put all these together, you can see that if you put them all together on top, we might as well do this. And I'll just keep doing this. And I'll go on like this. Well, how about a 5-pointed star as well? And how about a 7? And I've suddenly remembered the Aesculapianes, and there's the question of the volume of the sacred law. And then there's the logos symbol in the dexter chief and the sinister base and so on. We're getting very black, aren't we? Now, in Mecca, in the Kaaba, they have a stone. It's a black stone. Once upon a time it was white. But they say the kisses of the faithful made it black. Now, kiss means exactly that. In billiards, you know that. In pot black, kissing means that the two balls strike each other. Just like that. Not full on, but just touching the edge. That's a force, it's a tandem. Now it produces a response in both, like that. The original white stone, which represents pure being, became black by kissing, and kissing means contingent relationship. And contingent relationship means with touching. Like in the Bhagavad Gita it says the touching of the senses. Not only the sense touch, but the light hits me in the eye and goes on the retina, touches the retina. Little particles in the atmosphere go up my nose and touch nerves. All senses touching. And when we become so full of touches, we become black. We become, if we're not careful, diabolical. We know everything, and we could forget in self-knowledge that there are other beings. We can go about doing things in total insensitivity to what is happening to other people. And we'd then be a black ball. If you've got two black balls, you're not allowed in to the lodge. I imagine that that blackness can be converted. Now, the whole of yoga in India, in China, in Japan, has aimed at saying, although I am black, like William Blake says, little Negro, black, nevertheless, his soul is white. That is to say, he remembers he was an original free being. He does not have to be imposed upon by the knowledge, which is nothing but the records of the experience of his lifetime. So he can develop what is called a no mind. The Japanese term no mind, it doesn't mean you haven't got a content. It means you can ignore the content, scrub it out, and re-become the innocent that you once were as a baby. Now, there is an idolatry, and idolatry means formal worship. Now every idea is a product of the will. There's a V which means force vectored. There's another one, that's double. The reason it's double in the letter W is because when you will something, you change the situation, so the situation is not what it was before you started willing. So you've got a reaction that you have to cope with, so your will is always ambivalent. You start something and the situation changes, and you have to deal with the changes you have introduced. Therefore we have a W. Now that W posits an idea. There's the idea of the dot, and there's the indicator that shows where the dot is. That indicator was put on the paper because the dot on an early manuscript could easily be some little mark accidental in the paper or from a fly or whatever. You could misread it. So put a little vertical and then you can see where the dot is. Now, if that is an idea posited by an ambivalent will, the ambivalence is hidden in the I, in that letter. And if so, then when you come to conjoin to the object of your will, that's L, then the L must be double too. The L means a ligature, and you are bound by the doubleness of your will into an individuated idea of an act, and then you go into the act liking what you intended to put, but disliking the result of your action, producing a response in other people that you didn't calculate for. Now the word will means precisely that. That is said that the will, when it initiates the idea, comes through the idea, and the aftermotion of that is called desire. Desire means from the Father, desire, from the Father. The will posits an idea, pushes through the idea, the aftermotion or inertia of the released energy is desire. The L means a ligature, and you are bound by the doubleness of your will into an individuated idea of an act, and then you go into the act liking what you intended to put, but disliking the result of your action, producing a response in other people that you didn't calculate for. Now the word will means precisely that. That is said that the will, when it initiates the idea, comes through the idea, and the aftermotion of that is called desire. Desire means from the Father, desire, from the Father. The will posits an idea, pushes through the idea, the aftermotion or inertia of the released energy is desire, and that desire makes essence, which in your body is chemically predisposed to realize the idea, and that chemistry constitutes body. Now observe that. Our body is made of essential chemistry. The chemistry is a precipitate of desire, which is an emotive state, and the desire has arisen through an idea posited by the will to accomplish an object. Now this places total responsibility in the initiating will. Now how many of us like to think that everything that's ever happened to us has happened because we will to do things. And when we change the constitution of the universe, the big O and the little O inside. Because when we have an idea. And an idea has an implication. It's either towards relation with other beings or towards separativity, private purpose. And the emotion of relationship and the emotion of separativity are not identical. So, a relational person has a different contour physically to a separative. On an oscilloscope, we can get a wave from your brain and from your body and show you that when you're feeling relational, the wave movement in your brain is not identical with when you're feeling separative and private in your intention. And the chemistry of your body is a precipitate of your emotive state. And your emotive state is nothing but another name for your desire. And the desire is the aftermotion or inertia of an active will to posit an idea as a goal or aim to be attained. Now this means that whatever we get, whether it's good or bad, we have initiated a will to do so. And we have got a result. And the result of that will, the idea, with the will pushing through it, makes a desire an emotive charge, and the state of the biofield vibrating resonantly in a certain formal manner with a definite frequency per second of vibrations, producing geometrical configurations like heavenly figures. And those geometrical configurations vibrate in the being of the protoplasm, and they precipitate and synthesize chemistry in the body. And when the chemistry is established, it becomes a physiological, habitual fact. And when it becomes a physiological, habitual fact, in relation to that you are dead and a prey to vultures. What does that mean for us? It means that we have to go back, never mind our body condition. The chemical essence, the GP will tell you what you need chemically. Generally, you have to go to a psychiatrist to find out what your desire is, and he doesn't penetrate into the depths of your will. We could say this is the area of psychotherapy for those who respond to it. Just like this is the area for surgeons, and that is the area for biochemists, this is the area for psychology, and you can have a neurosis there. But it's up here where your psychosis is, where the will generates the idea. Now imagine a very deep disorder makes the average psychiatrist nervous. He doesn't like dealing with a psychotic. A mild neurosis is okay. But a very deep fundamental wrong orientation in the will, that one is very difficult to handle, if it's handleable at all. But there is the evolutionary process where from primordial will, which is God equals sentient power, coming down to the physical body of the universe and the physical body of the human being or any other living being. The process is identical for God and for humanity, for the race and for the individual. And if we call that evolution coming out from God, then going back that way would be involution back into God. But if we started at the bottom, like materialist scientists do, and say we are evolving and it's turning out, then we can only evolve, turn out, if we have already involved the powers from cosmic energy. So there is an involution and an evolution. And the materialist thinks we started as dumb material bodies, particles, and we ascend through chemistry, combinations, to a state of desire, and if we're lucky, we attain the condition of will, and we call that evolution. But presupposes an involution of those same powers. So it's really a rotation, a cycle of being. And if we were to do it both ways, we could please ourselves if we went that way or that way. And we've always got the choice there towards this side, the sinister, this side, the dexter, towards separativity or relationship. Now, because fundamentally we are power, and power is not separate at all from itself, We have no conceivable way of insulating ourselves absolutely from each other. If you have a physical body and you keep it separate, and you're sitting on a chair next to another person, your heat auras are commingling. And if we take today, with modern technology, a photograph of these two people, there's the lady sitting next to her husband. She's a little bit closer to the husband than she is to this fellow here. The heat aura there will show itself to be closer. And the heat aura there will have a bit of a space. That's physical heat, which you can photograph. But you've also got a biomagnetic field, which can become interesting. In which case you might have a distorted field. This charming lady might think this is a very handsome fellow. She might not say so. But if she thinks so, and feels so, her biofield will leak a bit that way. And if she's had cross words with her husband, have you ever done that, you know? If you ever have, your biofield will move away. Have you ever felt yourself with a difference of opinion that you do this? Well, when you do, your biofield distorts. You can actually get into the same bed at night, do you know that? And sleep on opposite sides of the bed. Even to the point of falling out on opposite sides. You're so determined to have a distance between you. If you had to put the camera on the ceiling and photograph you at that moment, and photograph the biofield, you found the biofields on opposite walls. And the two dead bodies in the bed. They're both cold, but they will not talk. You can't see them or sleep apart. You mean you're a relational being. Do you not find that you tend to forgive in the middle of the night, especially in winter? Well, there's an old saying, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. If you're really mad at something, you've got a bent biofield. If you put two bent biofields in the same bed, the biofields will spend the night out on the cold walls. And the feet of the bodies will be cold. Well, what we're saying is this. In top economical detail, you have the fact that every part of your organism is correspondent with the part outside in the big universe, and every part specializes in a certain function. So if we were to confine ourselves, say, to the solar system, and we'd have the sun shining merrily away there, and then we'd have Mercury, and Venus, and the Earth, and Mars, and Jupiter, Saturn, and so on, out to Pluto, planets, one after the other, in their respective orbits, we have exactly the same kind of thing in our body. We have a solar plexus, which has a function just like the sun in the solar system. And we have functions correspondent with those of the planets in our body. Well, just look at the generation of intelligence. First of all, I'm going to put Saturn. Now, Saturn is centripetal force, so I'm representing like that, pressing on the center. That's centripetal, that's Saturn. That's the start. That's the beginning of individuation. So Saturn is said to be a planet of great wisdom because it individuates. But the moment you press in like that, you restrain yourself and you have a reaction against the restraint. So the next one is Jupiter. And Jupiter represents centrifugal force, flying away from the center. Now, you're in a problematic situation. You like to exist because then you can say, I am I. But you don't like the restrictions, because when you become I, you become a target for other forces outside you. You can't stand up and exist and be I without being a target. If I said this, you know the word ordinary? It's from Latin ordo, which means a line. The ordinary is everything that stands in line like that. Imagine a lot of toes of soldiers like that, toeing the line. Those are soldiers' toes. Those are soldiers' thumbs. They're all toeing the line. That's an old dead level that they call ordinary. But if one stands out from the line and puts his toe over there, he's broken the line. He stands up. Here are the other ordinaries, like this. And what do the ordinaries do when they see one put his toe over the line? Do they like it? Or is he drawing attention to himself? Has he got beautiful toes? Usually he thinks he has if he dares put them out. The moment you exist, and the word exist means stand out from the ordinary will pull you down, if they can. If they can't, they'll pretend they helped you to get there. You might even remember the day they gave you your first job. And when you see that you have this doubleness, there's the V and there's the V, which make together W, you have a tendency to exist and to stand out, but you don't like being thrown at. You see that with all the great actors of the world, how everybody's watching and admiring and waiting for them to degenerate. Have you noticed that? Richard Harris, King Arthur, Camelot, Peter O'Toole. Did you notice how horribly he looked, the drunken rat? You see, they're waiting to pull him down because he was up. And they're so sad that this great man has sunk. Laurence Olivier's beautiful two-part life story. What a sad little fellow. All the ordinaries are waiting to get you down. Now, when they can't pull you down, they worship you and they pay the money to see you. But as soon as you become tipsy or have 10 wives by mistake, they'll start being rude. Remember Charles Chaplin, a comedian loved by everybody, and then suspected of communism. They had to drive him out of the boundaries. He couldn't live in America. It took years to re-enter. Think about this very carefully. This is a field of force. I'll redraw it like this. And there is the outstander. Now that's a sudden wave in a flat field. And when that sudden wave appears in the flat field, the field is strained because the part that's lifted up is stressed. Doesn't it mean that every clever fellow, in stressing himself, has strained all the others? This is a field of energy, a continuum, and when you push it like that, you've stolen a bit of energy from there, haven't you? Can you see that? You can't push that bit out without pinching a bit of energy. So aren't they quite correct to resent you sticking out in that way? In the mechanical sense, yes, because there is stress and therefore there is strain. And it's all double. There is no stress without strain around it. And there is no straining without producing the stress. So everything in the universe is ambivalent. So we'll say the centripetal and the centrifugal together produce Mercury. Mercury means rotation. And it goes into the Saturn, out to the Jupiter. And it keeps going in and out, in and out, in and out. When it goes in, it posits the being, and when it goes out, it dissipates the being. And it does it so rapidly, you think there is a being becoming process there. Being becoming. When you're spinning in that way, you have a quarrel inside you, and you don't know whether to be or not to be. You're like the unfortunate fellow Hamlet, who has a hierarchy, L factor, and he's crucified like that. That's Hamlet. He's got a sense of hierarchy, the state, himself, prince, and he's got a matter, a substance, and there's a link factor between them, and there is a crucifixion. That is Hamlet's problem. But it isn't only Hamlet's problem. Shakespeare didn't think it was Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. He thought it was every individual human being with the same problem. Shall we make an end of this matter by a bare bodkin, kill ourselves and get out? How do we know we are dead? Lord Soper tonight, in those highly educational religious broadcasts that we have on Sunday, said he wasn't terribly interested about the next world. Most of the people he knew knew no more about it than they do about this world, which is very little. And he wasn't bothered. He was trusting in the promise of Jesus Christ, who said, I will make a place for you in that world. But the ambiguity remains. He didn't know. And he didn't believe anybody else knows either what the next world means. But supposing the next world is not a world, next, like this, that's next. That's one world, that's another world, and they're next to each other. Supposing the diagram is false, supposing the reality is this, there is a world and there is a world, and when you focus onto your separative egotism there, you're in one world, and when you remember the big universe, you're in the other world. And these two worlds are mutually interpenetrating. So this very world that we're in now is the next world the moment we focus it. So we have a whizzing wheel there with a quarrel inside it. Mystically that's called a wheel of woe. You know, Wednesday's child is full of woe. Do you remember that? Can anybody recite the days for me? Monday's child is what? And Tuesday's child? Wednesday's child? And Wednesday is Mercury, do you? Yeah? Who's loving and giving? See, now Greta has recited the whole thing for us. It is a deep metaphysical truth, probably one of the most ignored truths there is. But it was actually composed by aristocratic initiatives of temple mysteries to remind themselves, and they taught the babies to recite it in case the father got drunk and forgot it. Now think about that. Wednesday child, that's Mercury, Mittwoch, is full of woe. He's grinding around, he's positing, he wants to get rid of it, and he doesn't want to get rid of it. So he goes round and round and round. That's your mind with a problem that it can't solve. And then, in the grinding round, it gets hot. So we put Mars there. And Mars means the heat of mental friction caused by the continuous consideration of the contradictions of existence. Existence is full of contradictions. It's all there. Now how are we going to solve the problem? Well, we can either back down, stop grinding away, fall back, abandon Saturn and go into that. Up there is called the abyss. That's before Saturn. Abyss means unwoven power. Unwoven. Bissos meant a fabric woven. Abyss means unwoven. That's infinite power with no form whatever. But it's got inside it a potential of a form, not realized. If when the heat gets too much, you back down, you go into non-existence. You fall into the abyss of non-being, which isn't very nice. It's called annihilation's waste. You have an alternative. The alternative is when it gets hot, speed up. And you say, something's got to happen. Something must happen. If I speed up. So you speed up. And something happens. The sun, light. You incandesce. At a certain critical point, you suddenly get the message. It's only me. Substantially doing eyes work, I posited it. I have enlightened myself. I've gone through the whole process. Now that is the involution of the light into an individual human being. Now we have a symbol, the moon. I'm going to draw it here and ignore this for a moment. The crescent moon. I want you to imagine that's the moon boat. And all these processes are inside the moon. The moon in the sky is a mineralized body with no living beings on it. It is the very essence of compacted potentialities of all that we have discussed. It contains a hidden light. It's actually light in the middle of the moon. And it has heat, and it has turbulence, and it has expansion and contraction, and it lives in the abyss. And that is the whole process. And that process must be gone through to attain what is called spiritual enlightenment. And spiritual enlightenment is nothing but the recognition... Yes, sir. Fancy that. I was hoping the ladies would mention that. Who cares about Venus? Venus is your natural state following your enlightenment. Yes? You want me to draw them all again, or will you make your own note? Silence. Now that's the one that's important. All those are in the moon boat. And that is the order, the only order that you can get them. There must be convergence, that's centripetal. There must be remembrance of freedom. Otherwise you come back and become profoundly egotistic and forget that there is a beyond your egoic intent. You must work hard, like Wednesday's child, full of woe. That's called the passion. That's the passion of messianic figures. They have to go through it. And then there will be fire. They'll have to descend to hell. Like Jesus in the story goes to hell to release what is hidden. What is hidden in there is Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury. Hidden in hellfire. And then suddenly you will incandesce. And when you've done that, you recognize the whole thing is a work of love. And it's taken place inside this moon boat. Now, if you get passion thoroughly, you can have crucifixion. And if you have crucifixion, you can have death, burial, and resurrection. You can't have a resurrection if you've not been crucified and dead and buried. And what is it that's to be dead and buried? What is called the old Adam, the old man. That is to say, your previous misconception of the nature of reality. That is original man. That is the stimulus, the knowledge of good and evil, double. And you've gone out to get that knowledge. That is your center. And you've left your center, made a false center on the periphery. So now, the real center is very faint, and there's a very strong center there on the periphery of being. Now, to move from true center to peripheral center is to move from spiritual awareness to egotistical crucifixion on the ambivalence of the world. The world is full of pleasure pain. What happens when we fall is quite simply we fall, we cover. We have a central intelligence which is perfectly balanced in all of us. It's always there, it's never destroyed, it's eternal. But our attention, our intention to the world actually takes the energy which ordinarily would be facing the center. That's called the angel constantly faces God. That energy leaves center and becomes interested in something in the outer world, something on the periphery of being, and when it gets to the periphery, it is trapped. And now the being is reactive. Every stimulus that hits it, it bounces back. And the person becomes one-sided. And the more powerful the egotistic structure, the more one-sided that being is. And the more that being will gradually be stored. It will go like that. And there's the true center, but here is a false center of egotism. And that false center of egotism there is called the old Adam. And we have to die as to it. That is to say, we have to actually let the thing rot and corrupt because it's useless. Have you thought how often when you insist on having your own way with somebody, then afterwards you don't feel that you did the right thing? If you win a battle with another human being, you're at fault. That you have won the victory means that you've superstressed a peripheral situation and made yourself thereby unbalanced. And somehow you've got to leave that misconception. The only way you can do it is by the passion. That is to say, you push hard into the experience of egotism. You take all the energy and you put it in, thinking, feeling, and willing. You push it in to that center and you become a prodigal. And you say, if I'm going to be really bad and stupid, I'm going to be thorough about it. So I really deeply understand stupidity. Because not until we thoroughly understand it can we give it up. The prodigal son cannot turn round and go back to true center, that's called father's home, until he's gone down to the pigs and the externals called the husks. Now there is no other way of developing the human being from his primary precipitation there to the full enlightenment there with the love that rises with it within that body other than through those steps. We must converge, we must remember the infinite beyond, we must relate the two, we must work very, very hard and get the heat up, that's called zeal, real interest in the work, then we will become enlightenment embodied, and then we will love the whole process. It's a process called the process of divinization, of sinification, the process of producing the Messiah within, called the Emmanuel. Every human being is capable of that work. But if he's only partially gone down and has dodged the pains, he hasn't learned the lesson. I put to you a simple little question. If you were to remove the consequences of the acts of all your friends, so that whenever they did anything wrong, you removed the results surreptitiously, so that they never had the product of their wrong action, could they develop? Not possible, is it? So wouldn't it be essentially unethical to remove the results of actions from people and so deprive them of a true possibility of evaluating their own action and being? It would be in the highest degree unethical. If you had a child, and every time the child did something wrong, you covered it up so that nobody complained, nobody punished, and you gave it millions of excuses for its bad behavior, could the child grow up and become a mature human being? No. And the same with us. If we do not face the consequences of our action, and accept them and affirm them, and investigate them 100% thoroughly, we cannot learn. And here's the process. How do we do it? First we initiate, and say we centripetalize, we get the field energy and posit that energy, and having done so, we remember that we were free before we did it. Now Jupiter means God the Father, but we put him second. The first one is God the Devil. Saturn, Satan is an analog. Now we're going to draw the whole being like this, and we're going to put a double triangle, and in the top there we're going to put God smiling, and across there we're going to put water. This is water. Now fire is spirit and water is matter, plastic substance. Now the water reflects what is above the water, so we've got the face down here, the downturned mouth. That's the devil. Diabolos est deus in versus. The devil is only the reflection of God upside down in matter. Funnily enough, in theology, there is no supreme entity called the devil. There is only a principle of negation called the devil, a principle of refusal of life called the devil, but not an entity called the devil. Because there is only one absolute entity, and that is God. That is the infinite sentient power. Now here are the arms of God, like that, and here are the black arms of the devil, like that. And whatever is in God there is inverted and suffers from inertia down in the water. And that is initiative up there. God is always starting things. And when you're initiating, you are free. But when the initiated act establishes itself as a habit, you are bound. And when you're bound, you're in hell. You have to face the consequences of your action. People don't generally like it, but in fact, if you don't do exactly what the Messiah does, he goes down into hell, studies inertia, and comes out and goes back to heaven. That is an exact process, involution, evolution, in another diagram. Consider this. Initiative is free, intelligent power starting things that didn't exist before. But inertia is a continuance of those things that are started, and the inertia has no freedom. And consequently, is mechanical. So down here is mechanics. And do you like to think about yourself as mechanical being? Not much. Now the opposite of a mechanical being is a free being. You put free up there. Bound down here. If we accept that we are initiating beings, that we always have been, from the moment of conception, we start taking over the directives of our life, and we develop in the womb, independently of the mother, although stealing from her the food we need. Remember, we make our own placenta, we feed on the mother, we kick when we feel like kicking, we put our arms out when we feel like it. If we don't like mummy's position, we kick, so she has to change position. And we are always conducting our own process from the moment of conception. And when we come out into the world, we then fight the lady who suckered us within the womb. We fight because we don't want to be dictated to, and we are independent individual beings. But we are quickly bound up, put in a nappy for the convenience of the civilized. We might not care where we defecate. Most mothers do. And before taking us to our first birthday party, they tend to tie us up and make us decent and ignore the results of overfeeding. All the time the baby is bound. In some countries, this is a typical baby. Well, how would you like to be like that? That's a baby. New baby. You know why it's wrapped up like that? Can't get into trouble. And some countries wrap the babies up like that. In what we call Western civilization, they don't do that. They wrap them up with words and with moral suggestions. They use words as efficiently as an Indian would tie up a papoose. And the words don't look like bombs, but they are. If we don't get bound like that, we cannot feel our power, our potential of expression. We never become properly individuated until we are thoroughly aware that we are bound by our own will. Now, have we any ground of complaint in any way about anything whatever that happens to us if we know that we did it? Isn't it illogical to say, here am I in the world and I'm being badly treated? The answer is, what are you doing here? How did you get here? Don't tell me that you didn't want to be conceived, because you actually developed yourself from a point of conception. You are here and therefore you're in trouble. Now, if you accept that and affirm it and say, I'm going to investigate trouble. Very good things like how to make a dovetail joint in carpentry. Those are very pleasant. You can investigate those nice things that are worth doing. But they're not as illuminating as wrong things. You get a wrong cup when you're making your dovetail joint, and when you come to fit it together, it won't fit. And then arises in you heat and annoyance. And the next time you use your saw and your little measuring devices in your wood, you'll be what is called more careful. The increased care is a product of your suffering from your unfortunate accidents through lack of looking what you're doing. Now, how do we feel if we accept fully, 100%, where we are now with whatever we've got of deficiencies or merits? Whatever we have, it's our own fundamental work. We've done it. There's no ground of complaint anywhere to anything. We are here. We put ourselves here. We impose on ourselves. We suffer the consequences. And if we affirm the consequences and deliberately crucify ourselves, then we have a nice black old Adam, the old man, full of errors to contemplate. And then by a simple inversion, we take all the errors, turn them upside down, and they are now all virtues. Who knows more how to help than a good first-class sinner? The greater the sinner, the greater the saint. I often look back with regret on my life for not having sinned enough. Rather like a song called the Sally Gardens, which you probably know. You get opportunities in youth and you're full of ethics. By the time you're my age, you couldn't take advantage of a rotten offer. Yeah, I missed out on wisdom. Every day I'm looking for new errors. And they're very, very hard to find. Now, most of the errors that people get into, they fall in through not looking, and the errors are repetitive. There's a psychological law called the law of the persistence of error. The errors that you commit are not worth doing. You've done them before. It's just that you haven't learned the lesson. Now, if you said to yourself, I'm not going to commit the same error again, but I'm going to discover new errors, new things. So you read Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy to get a collection of sins. And you say, well, those have been done in the long body of human protoplasm. I must find a new one. Can you feel your interest rising? You start striking a light as if you are martial intent to learn to be a real super horror. But it's very hard work. I challenge you, any of you. I'll give you 5p. Yes, that's a lot of money to me. I'll give you 5p if you can tell me a new sin that I haven't heard of already. Where are all the apples? I can't hear you rushing. Have you got one? Desperately, yeah. Well, I'm glad. I'll tell you the truth. If I've not heard it before, I'll confess. And if I've not heard it before, I'll tell you, it's not in the book. There's a big fat book of errors called the Black Book. Seriously, I'm telling you, you can go home if you like and think about it all night. Try and think of a new sin you've not already sampled in some measure, or that you heard about friends sinning, and make a note of it and give it to me and I'll do it. Because at the end of it, I'll be that much wiser. And if you haven't got the nerve to do it, then I have, I'm one up on you. It's your sin power. How do you feel about it? If you think you deliberately do things, and if you were to do them accidentally, you'd call them errors. And if you do them deliberately, they're not errors at all. They're investigations into the nature of terminal sin. In the sense we've had S-I-N. You're studying the negation of your own powers by your self-imposition. And if you complete the cycle, then you have an eternal body of sentient power, which is not gross material body and cannot corrupt. But you can sail about in that original soul body, entirely characterized by the totality of your temporal matter experiences. How does that feel? Okay? That means that from now, I can say every time I see you, you're looking wiser, more balanced, more peaceful, because you have deliberately sinned more often.